I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi friends, Editor Alex here. I just wanted to do a quick introduction for this audio recording of Let's Talk About Cycling and Mental Health. It's been something that's cropped up in numerous events that we've hosted at Look Mum No Hands, other events that I've been to, and it was actually on this podcast that I did a shout out and I said, any events that you would like us to host, get in touch, let me know, maybe. So it was at, I believe, the Specialized event. Someone came up to me and said, I'd like you to do an event about cycling and mental health. From that, we tweeted and said, who's interested in helping us organize an event about this? That's how we got in touch with Sarah Strong. Sarah met me and Jenny at an event. She curated the evening. She organized the speakers. It was a really moving and powerful panel. Big, big, big thank you, Sarah, for organizing this. Thank you to our host, Rebecca Chilton, our speakers, Adele Mitchell, Bruce Carsten, Jules Walker, and Rowan Gush. I also want to say thank you to Leslie for taking the time to help live tweet the event, and Kaz from the North London Thundercats Black Metal Bicycle Club for helping with our Facebook Live as well. And I don't want to take up any more of your time. I'm going to put links below, and I'm going to let you listen to it now.
So I'm Rebecca, and I'm going to be chairing tonight, but I wanted to start by saying it's really about you, our audience, our panellists, and really getting an open discussion going tonight, so we will get interactive a little bit later on, as well as taking some questions from Twitter and social media. And remind me of the hashtag, is it CyclingMH?
CyclingMH, cycling underscore, and then capital M, capital H, if you want to involve yourself in the conversation going on Twitter.
Yeah, so please do get involved and give us your insight there as well. So before we go any further, please join me in welcoming tonight's panel. Please put your hands together for Adele Mitchell, George Walker, Chris Carsten, Warren Gosh, and the lady that has made tonight possible and put it all together at Sarah Strong. Thank you. So before I hand over to Sarah to talk a little bit more about tonight and why we're here and why it was so important to her to put tonight on, I wanted to add a little bit of insight from my perspective as a journalist. And after many years of working in print journalism, I've interviewed so many people, as you can imagine, about the benefits of cycling and how much it can improve your state of mind, help with weight loss, help with general well-being. And we all know it's a fantastically positive sport. It brings friendship, support networks, and it's truly brilliant. But something that struck me is that we perhaps didn't then look beyond the headline of, well, I have depression and now I'm great thanks to cycling. And actually 6 months, a year down the line and beyond that, what happens when you have a crash or you get too ill to be able to ride a bike at that point? Do you still have that support network? Do you still have those tools to turn to when you can't necessarily ride your bike, which is the thing that helps you progress in the first place? And I know that we've got some speakers here tonight that are very happy to be open and give anecdotes of the times where they've had a very great relationship with cycling and when times have been a little bit more of a struggle. And I'm sure a lot of people here can relate to that. So there's real ups and downs with it, and I think it's important that we all acknowledge that. But as I say, without further ado, let's hand over to Sarah and tell us a little bit about why we're all here.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I was thinking when I was proposing this, around about sort of June, July, like all the best events, with the sort of fervent belief post-beer that something should be kind of put on. It's a really good idea to do something like this. And I was thinking maybe there'll be about 15 to 20 people, you know, enough for it not to be embarrassing. I really didn't expect the result of the feedback. So thank you very much for everyone for coming on today. I think it has underscored the fact that a lot of these conversations do need to happen. There's lots of sort of discussions about sort of awareness, but actually doing something a bit more practical than that and going for the next step and having a kind of conversation rather than just kind of talking about it in a very sort of social media bubble or just sort of campaigning, but actually getting down to the nitty-gritty of having sort of conversations one-to-one or within groups. Some of you know me, most of you won't. I've sort of been lurking around the various circles of London cycling over the last sort of 40, 50 years, and whether that's organising mountain bike races, marshalling events like the Stockton, crit racing, bit of track cycling, run cross race. My city's got dirty, I didn't like it. Just sort of what the conversations that seemed to sort of come up again and again were about this sort of seemed to be this huge overlap between cycling and people who experience depression, anxiety, and other mental issues, health issues, but particularly depression and anxiety. And I was just sort of curious, it seemed to be higher than the national average, which I think, depending on the sources you look at, are somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 3 people within the UK will go through depression in any given year, which is huge. So I was sort of wanting to sort of focus on that. And because I have a very personal kind of experience myself, the reason I got into cycling was when I was recovering from depression in 2003. And it was kind of by accident. My then housemate said, do you want to come and help her marshal the race that my club are doing? Because she knew I'd been lucky. I was around the house, I signed off work, and she thought it would be something different for me to experience. And I ended up getting involved with the Eastway mountain bike races, which were then on the old Eastway track, which was then developed the Olympics later on. And it was this, like many people, it ticked so many boxes. It gave me exercise, it gave me a new social circle. Cycling was a way of focusing on the physical and lessen the rumination that goes with a lot of depression and anxiety. And I think I probably fell into one of those, cycling is brilliant, it just hits everything, it's great. But then as your experience, I think, in the cycling world goes on, and you might do, particularly when it comes to doing competitive cycling, you realise that it's not all rainbows and unicorns, and actually there's a kind of flip side to it where you can end up exacerbating your anxiety, depression, depending on the focus and the pressures you put on yourself within those particular environments. I sort of contributed a few pieces a little while back to internet, sort of Total Women Cycling, but also to Cycling Weekly, and there were these sort of phases, the phrases that came up, cycling saved my life. And it was that sort of sense that it was a kind of almost implying that it was a cure-all. And you get things like this that there are plenty of motivational messages which actually kind of annoy me quite a bit. So things like, you cannot be riding a bicycle. I'm like, yes, you fucking can. you can be crying and riding a bicycle. It's quite easy. I don't need therapy, I just need to go cycling. I think if anything, the sort of, you know, don't run away from your problems, cycling is much faster, is something that came up a few weeks ago. If anyone was here for the Adventure Syndicate talk, where particularly with endurance events, that sense of actually we're doing these to actually kind of escape from our problems, but also brought up kind of issues about mental health of what do you do when you get back? And you've got to adjust from something that's giving you huge highs and lows to, oh crap, I've got to go and buy milk. And just those sort of shifts in dynamics and emotions, how you handle them. So I thought, well, I want something to counter that. So I did a Google image search for depressed cyclists. And awkwardly, the first three images that came, of the five images that came up, the first three are of me. fuck. So, okay, right. I watch out for tax people. Be careful of your image check because. But yeah, I'm a good company now with Graham O'Brien and some random stock photo kind of head clutcher, which is great. But I think it's the thing that we wanted to cover this evening is that in the past, the idea of cycling as an absolute kind of cure-all, I mean, it's not realistic. And to have a look at the other side of that, of the highs and lows of competitive cycling, or just how you react as well within, as you go through that very steep learning curve about your own mental health and how it interacts with your life and cycling and how to manage that. I think what we sort of wanted to out of this evening is to, again, just have those kind of conversations. Say we're in a sort of a space where a lot of people, you know, will have experienced that a similar idea. We all have our individual experiences, but there's an awful lot of overlap of how we react there. And it's kind of good to have that chat in an open space, and hopefully we can continue doing that. And also, if we can provide a bit of information about where to go and what sources of help to kind of access, you'll see that there are some handouts which I've sort of cobbled together. But hopefully, we can, at the end of the evening, we can talk a little bit more about perhaps our. I kind of ask questions about our individual experience, and we can have a bit more of a discussion and a Q&A. But we're hoping at the end of the evening we can kind of give you a sense that even if things are tough now, that maybe everything isn't hopeless bullshit, and that even if it kind of seems really tough, that there is kind of light at the end of the tunnel. Because it seems when you're in it and you're so immersed in your kind of mental health, depression, anxiety, it's very difficult to see beyond it. But it is possible to get to the other side. It might be cycling, it might be a combination of cycling and other things, but there are sort of avenues and sources that you can use to improve your situation, whatever that may be. I think I've babbled on quite enough now, so I'm good. At this juncture, we're going to have a lovely short clip, and then you'll hear from the rest of the panelists. But thank you for listening to me briefly, and okay, we'll come back at the end of the evening and we'll take a few more questions and have a bit more chat.
There's a lot of other people out there, so many people struggling. I thought, right, if we go for an honesty, then that's great. Kind of what I was, it didn't seem great, but I never realised in retrospect that it was a great thing to do because I feel hard, but there was a book itself, and I thought, no, well, you know what, it's a good function. And if people are writing to me saying thanks for writing it as honesty. I think a lot of mental health has to do with hard resentments and ill feeling or anger or suppressed. There's a lot of suppressed feelings, and actually not just tell people, oh, excuse me, you're taking a loan on me. And dealing with things, not letting things fester, not worrying about things, deal with them right away. I've got a certain lifestyle, but I don't let too much negative get me in. If something annoys me, I've got to deal with it right away because I can't let things fester. Actually, cycle is both good and bad because you can use it as a form of hiding away. Like cycling on your own and walking around the countryside on your own is the same as hiding a forest on your own, which I did in childhood. So that can be an escapism. So I have to use it as a positive way for exercise and to try and engage with people. And I think if you do more than cycling, so like you can actually talk to real people, not people in the pub, you have a real conversation, To be honest, actually, if you're seeking extreme endurance events, then that's a sign that you're actually using that event as a hide from something. You're still hiding away. You use that as a form of suppression rather than making it feel good. Because you're just going to bike right along the seafront and listen to seagulls and watching just nature is therapeutic. If you know what's actually eating up yourself, what you're going to tell somebody thinks it's annoying you, then you know what's actually eating up. And you go, what are we going to do about it? what we're going to do, what's in your, what's your job or your situation or whatever it is. Some things are very different, you work with this. Some things, you can't change things with your social situation, but you can find new ways of dealing with it or coping with it. It's a hard one, you just can't say to your friends, don't go, oh, I feel so depressed, to your friends, because you go, oh, well, they can't really help you, aren't actually. What they can do to help you, go to your friends and say, listen, what are you doing today? Pick up the phone, text people, say, oh, I've not seen you for a while, could you catch up with me over coffee? And then you say, oh, I'm a bit flat. Feel a bit flat, but we could catch up with you and your fair cheer me up. And that's the thing, don't dwell. Anyway, good luck on your bike ride. More than anything, enjoy, you'll meet some interesting people, and stay at night.
Hello, we're back.
So for anyone watching at home on Facebook Live, for anyone that could hear that very well from the back, that was Graham O'Bree talking about his battle with depression, which has been quite well documented in the press. And there's various topics there about keeping the conversation going that, of course, we can expand on more throughout this evening. So now I'm going to hand over to Bruce from Soul & Goat. He's a brand ambassador for them. So, Bruce, over to you.
Hi, good evening, everybody. I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak this evening. I'm not an authority on depression. Other than that, I do suffer from depression. So what I'm going to share with you tonight is just a little bit, I suppose, about the raw reality of it. It's been about 3 months and 16 days since I had a breakdown. I count the days like anybody else, I suppose, who suffered from anything and put it behind them. Each day for me is a step forward. And I think on the way to recognising it, I made a decision that I wanted to talk about it. I'm 36 years old. I've got a lot of life left in me. And there's a lot of guys and girls out there that will be experiencing or have experienced what I've gone through and maybe not had the opportunity to talk. I've been given the gift of the gab. I've spent most of my life, 14 years as a teacher, so talking is not an issue for me. And so it's just coming to the point where I can talk about this, that's been the key. About May this year, it gets to the end of the year for the teachers and things start to get tough. And this year just seemed to be a little bit different. You always go through tough parts and then you get the holidays. You get those two-thirds of the year that everybody tells you get for holiday, you just put your feet up. And so I kind of was looking towards that. But things started to get a bit tough. And I've written a couple of things down. I'm going to read them because I think the way I've written them since I experienced them kind of puts me into a little bit of perspective. And things started to show themselves. Like I felt down for no reason, no explanation. I just knew that I was feeling down and I needed to be alone. It sounds pretty standard, but it was really real, the compelling feeling of I just didn't want to be around people. And the fact that I can put 6 sentences together this evening is another testament that I'm coming out of it. I used to stutter. I couldn't sit in front of even my wife and have a conversation without stuttering so badly that I burst into tears. I stayed quiet in meetings for fear of ending up stuttering, which I knew would manifest itself the minute I put myself under pressure. I was definitely trying to avoid these and try to control my emotion for fear of bursting out in front of my colleagues. I'm a 36-year-old South African. I don't cry, but I was going to cry. Mistakes became evident. I prided myself in being really good at my job, and I started to muck up and a lot. And it became obvious to me. I was tired and not sleeping. I think in the last 2 weeks is the first time I've slept through the whole night. I think if I've had 3 hours consistent sleep in a night in the last 3 months, that's probably... I'm stoked. That's a good thing. So that was starting to take its toll. I felt and looked like a mess, and so I started to work on my outward appearance. I'd go to the barber for a shave and a haircut, not that I've got much hair to talk of, but I felt that if I at least looked decent, then I could get through the day. But inside, I definitely knew that I wasn't right. I started to head off to the bathroom to cry a lot during work. I would find reasons to do it. You know, I'm feeling ill or whatever. But I just had to be away, and I couldn't do anything but cry. And this continued for a long time. And I used other reasons to explain why I wasn't attending meetings, wasn't attending events. And in fact, I actually blamed it on cycling to one particular end. That didn't work very well for me, but I was happy that cycling took the hit and I was going on a trip to France with some mates. And that trip, in a way, became the beginning of the time for me to get better. I went on the trip, and some of these mates are sat here tonight, and I think at some point that was good fun, but in some points I think it was just absolute hell to live with. And one day, Graham talks about the endurance and kind of hiding. Something happened while we were away, and I just rode, I don't know, it must have been 80 or 100K, I don't know, and I just rode. I rode hard, I didn't care who was behind me. I knew I was in a lot of pain, and I think I got to the end of the ride and I just fell off the bike, and I was kind of finished. It was pouring with rain, and I just sat outside. And it's at that point I just realised that actually things weren't getting better. I came back to the UK, and I spent the next day in bed. I phoned one of the guys here who let me chat to his wife, and she said, "You really need to get to the doctor. You need to do something about it." But deep down inside, I kind of knew that if I did something about it, it would change that minute. I couldn't continue in my life as a teacher and carer and so forth. In my head, I'd have to give up so much the minute I disclosed or somebody then diagnosed that I was suffering from depression. And so it kind of put me off. And I went to see my doctor, and she said, "You know, don't worry about it. You're a teacher. You'll be fine. Do a bit of exercise. Cycling's good. You know, do that if you can. Have a good holiday, get away from things, and you'll come good. Don't worry about it." And so I took that as literal, and I said to Helen, "Don't have time to worry about. I'm on the mend, I just need a bit of a holiday." And the rest of that week was terrible. It ended up that on the Friday, I phoned every practice within 5 miles of where I lived to try and speak to somebody who could help me. And nobody was available. I had to wait till the Monday. And that day, my wife and I went to a doctor, and she talked me through the fact that I was suffering from severe depression. And I just gave over to it. I realized, okay, you've got it. You've got depression. And no matter what you're going to do, you're going to have to deal with it. And so I went on medication from that day. Medication that, pretty heavy stuff. I'm not going to lie. I mean, if you've got depression and medication is a thing that's going to help you, it's hard. And there's side effects. But I can now sit in front of you 3 months on having a conversation because of a support network that I've got, and my wife has been incredible. If you've got a partner or a best friend or a wife or a husband, that can stand by you. I think that's key. It's like you've got a broken arm. I've got depression. I have a faith as well. I'm a Christian. That's important to me. It's something else that I lean on very heavily. And that supports me, and I rely on that. And I've got a good bunch of friends, close friends, who didn't judge me when I just wanted to ride. I didn't talk, because talking meant I would stutter. Stutter would mean that I'd cry, and crying meant that I would, couldn't look good. But I just be able to ride with them. They didn't ask me how I was doing because I couldn't tell them how I was doing. I didn't know myself how I was doing. And that's been the journey. And the part that for me is that cycling has always been a part of my life. It was the thing that I ran to in the beginning. Endurance events, I performed well, I did a bit of competition, and I did fairly well for what I thought for my age group. But I noticed that as I was getting ill, that was on the down as well. And I used to head to the shop on the way home. I'd actively drive a route home that meant I could stop at a cafe to buy a Diet Coke, because it's Diet Coke, Coke Zero, to be fair. And then finish a 500-gram block of chocolate before I got home. And if I finished it before I got home, I'd probably stop at the cafe just before home to buy another one that I could have at home. And the feeling that I had after that was terrible, because cyclists don't eat chocolate. Cyclists don't eat fizzy drink. They drink fizzy drinks. We're meant to have these bodies that perform on the bike. And so I then feel terrible about that, and I want to get on the trainer, but when I got on the trainer, my numbers and my data weren't adding up because I was feeling unfit, and the medication was playing on that. And so I started not to cycle. and didn't want to go out with my mates because once I was competitive and I was the guy at the back and struggling and not able to complete 50K. And so it just became this fight between something that was good and something that was now pulling me down. And it's only been about a month until I changed the mindset of it. And I think cycling is not something that saved me. There's other stuff in my life that saved me, and I'm a Christian, that's my hope. But my cycling is something that helps me. It's like the medication I take. The medication helps me with adrenaline, it helps me with slow release in the day so I can get through a day positively. Cycling adds to that. I get on the bike and I have a good feeling, but when I get home, I've still got to deal with life. And I think we mustn't run away from the things we've got to deal with in life by using sport. Sport is a means to end. And I love cycling. And I hope to compete in the age group worlds later next year. I hope that my medication, being a cyclist, the first thing I did, I'm going to show you. So I meant to read some other stuff, but I'm going to show you this. This is quite funny. Well, I find it funny. So when the doctor prescribed me medication, the first thing I said to her was, is it on the banned list? She didn't know. So I said, is it? I'm a cyclist and I can't take stuff that will mean I'm on the banned list. My wife's going, you're an amateur, don't worry about it. I need to know. So anyway, she didn't know. My wife couldn't tell me. And so I went onto WADA's list and I printed off. So I've got it here. I carry it in my back pocket. It says the ingredients and the state of drug I'm on. Route of administration, as long as it's not intravenous, I'm safe. In competition, not prohibited. Green light. Out of competition, not prohibited. Green light. So I've got it. I can prove it. So yes, the drugs make me slow anyway. So and make me fat, actually. So I don't think there would be a problem with it. But that's my mindset. I needed to make sure that I had my goals in the right place. And it was making sure that the medication wasn't going to make me not compete. Never mind getting better. But yeah, I'm 3 months, 16 days in. Tomorrow will be 3 months, 17 days in. Last Friday was a terrible day. I slept most of last Friday. Today, I did the washing. I had an interview, and I came here. Tomorrow, I'm meeting a friend. I don't know what's happening. I don't have a job anymore. I quit my job by choice because it wasn't helping me get better. I needed to put that behind me to progress. So the rawness of it is I suffer from depression. I'm a cyclist who loves being on the bike. I don't always want to get on the bike. I don't have a job, but I'm not worried about that because that will come. Today was a good day. I don't know what tomorrow is going to be like, but ask me tomorrow and I'll tell you I'm not worried about it right now. It's about getting through each minute of each day. And for those guys that are watching on Facebook, for those guys and girls that are sitting here, if you're suffering from symptoms that aren't normal, you got to tell somebody because it's not normal. The stuff I've told you tonight is real and people can help you with it. And I think the stigma with depression and something being taboo and silent, it's got to end. There's help for it. It doesn't end your life. It starts it. It starts the next chapter. And so if you've heard something tonight that touches a nerve somewhere, do something about it. Chat to somebody. We're in a culture now where things like this should be accepted. I was on the train on the way here, I'm going to finish now, and there was an advert on the wall that said something about no discrimination. It was, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a white man, I'm a black man, I'm a this and that and this. And at the last point it said, I'm a depressive. And I kind of looked and I thought, do you know, you do get put in a box. You do get put in a box. But it's because people put you in a box that means that they're talking about it, they're thinking about it, and so let's do something about it. Thank you.
Bruce, thank you. Please put your hands together. Okay, we're going to hand the microphone over to Adele Mitchell now, of course, fashion and cycling writer, blogger and journalist. So over to you for your story, Adele.
I guess my story is slightly a different angle on mental health, in that I discovered cycling about 20 years ago, oh no, 15 years ago. I had three small children under the age of five at that point and had lost myself, which is quite easy to do when you have children that age. And I got on a plane to go skiing, lucky me, and it was an easy jet plane, and the brochure in front of me was open on a page for the London Triathlon, and I looked at it and I thought, well, I can run and I can swim and I can ride a bike. Couldn't do any of them to any degree of skill, and I wasn't fit, but I thought, I'm going to enter that. And that year I did do the London Triathlon, despite having three children under five. hated the swimming. Running I could take or leave, cycling totally fixed. I loved the cycling. I'm very fortunate to live in an area where there is abundant mountain biking. That is what I do. So I started to ride my mountain bike more and more. I actually rode the London Triathlon on a mountain bike. more and more cycling. I made friends through mountain biking. Skills developed. I got a lot fitter. Mountain biking became something that I did 3-4 times a week. I'm a journalist. At the time, I was writing about health and beauty, expert on the scale. And although I'd done that for a long time, I knew it wasn't going to be the whole of my career. And through social media, I started to write about my mountain biking, and then one thing led to another, as it often happens with 3 months of journalism. And I was approached to write for Total Women's Cycling, and started to do that, and have written for all sorts of titles since, including Single Track, I write for Evans, lots of different titles about women's mountain biking. So I am passionate about cycling because it kind of helped me to find me again after a period of my life where I'd been totally immersed in looking after small children. I made new friends, I got really fit. It enabled me to be outside. I'd previously been a very keen horse rider, and I think there's a sort of crossover there in that challenge that the sport brings and the opportunity to be outside is just a really wonderful combination. I think we're meant to be in the woods. This is my hippie moment. I think we're meant to be in the woods. We come from the woods. It's good for us to be amongst the trees. Having a sort of micro-adventure in your own little wilderness, even if you're only actually in Surrey. So it's gone on, and it's been wonderful. And then social media really came along, and as a journalist, a freelance journalist, you really need to be using Instagram, and you need to be doing Facebook and Twitter. And I started to notice on Instagram there was a kind of shift in how mountain biking was being represented. And instead of focusing on the mental health, the fitness, the climbing the hills, that had all gone. And it had all become about posting pictures of yourself getting air. Nothing else mattered as long as you had two wheels off the ground. And then the other thing is your injuries achieved whilst getting air. All about being a hardcore athlete who showed no fear. That wasn't my experience of mountain biking. I really admire everybody, by the way, who talks about cycling and crying, because you can't ride a mountain bike and cry. One, you can't see where you're going, and two, the hills are just too steep. You can't breathe and cry. How on earth? That's such a skill. So I kind of wanted to pull back and go, you know what, this isn't what mountain biking means to me. I think it's going to put more people off than involve them. So I wrote a post in the summer on my own blog about a particular route that I cannot navigate because it's just too technically beyond me. And I have been taken there by really experienced riders, and they've gone, this is what you do, just lift the bars, da, 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 da. I've watched my friends do it. I cannot do it. And I wrote a post about how that made me feel, because I wanted to just come back and go, you know what, it's not all jumping over the ravines in the sunset. It made me feel awful that I couldn't do it. And I really started to think about, why can't I do it? why am I, what am I bothered about here, and what is frightening me about this? And even though I have been injured riding a mountain bike and injured quite badly, that wasn't what was frightening me. What was frightening me was being the one in the group that couldn't do it and how they would feel about me because of that. I think the, being the one at the back is a universal fear, and I'm just reading a really great book which actually says, don't worry about feeling like you're the one at the back and feeling bad about it, because you're meant to feel bad about it, because a million years ago, you would have been the one that was eaten. Nobody wants to be the one at the back. So I posted this post, and then I kind of waited for everyone to go, we thought you were good at cycling, not following you anymore. But that isn't what happened. I had such a response from people going, thank you for saying that, because I feel like that too, and I don't understand why I can't do things when everybody else can. One wonderful post from a girl who, on Instagram, who had published a picture of herself actually riding an enduro and making a really good job of it, but had put, I'm just posting this because this morning I was sitting in my van crying because I was so frightened of what I was going to do today and making a fool of myself. And then she said, she mentioned my post and a couple of other things. She said, you know what, I've pulled myself together and I've gone, I'm doing this for me. And that's what's important. And if I finish this day knowing that I've done my best, that's good enough. So I just kind of wanted to reclaim the whole thing. You know, I'm 53 and I'm still worried about what's on Instagram. So how on earth are people who are much younger and coming into it feeling? You know, I'm supposed to be old enough to be above all these things. No, I'm not. I'm going, oh my. And as we said earlier, I'm also guilty of going out and thinking, I really need a really rad photograph of myself here. I'm married to a photographer. Poor lad has to stand there on the side of the trail with an iPhone, which he hates using because it's so beneath him. Well, I just do it again because I haven't dropped my heels enough that time. You know, and over and over again, trying to get this great photograph. I'm casually posting it like, yeah, this just happened. No, it didn't. I've tried millions of times. So I'm kind of, let's just get it real. And just remember why we all do this, which I met a guy on last week who was a 73-year-old mountain biker on an e-bike. And see mountain bikers in the woods were all a bit like, oh, see you're on an e-bike. And he said to me, well, I do ride my normal bike. He said, but it tires me out and I'd rather come out more often on an e-bike than less often on my normal mountain bike. He said, because I like being in the woods, because it's good for my mental health. So that's where we need to get back to, I think.
Thank you so much. Please put your hands together for Joe Mitchell. Now we're going to have the microphone back down that way. It's Noel Gosh of Black Dog CC.
Thank you. Just to say first, very inspiring, and it's really interesting to hear other people's perspectives and what's happened to them. I think what I'd like to do is just talk a bit about me and what how I experienced this, and then to talk really about Black Dog and what we're trying to do with Black Dog Cycle Club. I don't remember a time where I haven't woken up feeling crap. I mean, basically, I'd say probably 5 days out of seven in a week, I feel rubbish when I wake up. I feel, and it's, you know, I listen to what you were talking about, and I hear, you know, when I'm talking to my friends about this, and people who are suffering, this cloud coming onto people and it being something they go through. I feel like every morning, and I have done as long as I can remember, or most mornings, there's just this thing on me that's, I've got to almost fight this thing to get into the day. And it just hangs over everything. It hangs over me, it hangs over my perspective. And I think, like a lot of people I've spoken to who experience this, you go through life and you think, if I am successful, if I am popular, if I look good, if I am X, Y, and Z, this will go. But actually, it doesn't work like that. And so specifically, I've been prescribed antidepressants since the age of, since 20, I think, since university. And, but to this day, I've never taken one. And the funny thing is, it's cyclical. I get up most mornings, I feel terrible, I have to do exercise. It's one of the only ways I can combat it. Then I feel okay. I tell the doctors about this, and immediately they say, well, you need, this is an issue, you need to deal with your anxiety, you need to deal with your depression, go on a course of antidepressants. And each time, I just think, no, I can beat this. And it's just carried on in this cyclical way where I get, it feels like it's getting better and better, and then suddenly it gets worse. I go back to the doctor and I think, I'll have these tablets here, I'll look at them, but I won't take them. And it's had some quite big impacts in my life. I would safely say that up until the age of kind of 30, I'm 40 now, up until the age of 30, I was scared to be myself. You know, part of this anxiety that I woke up with was, what is this cloud in front of you? What does that make me? How can I get beyond this? And medicating myself in different ways, through alcohol, through drugs. And really, from 30, just being so exhausted, just exhausted of this cycle. And then it was about, you know, achievement. You know, can I do this? Can I do that? Can I reach the top of my profession? Can I run a successful business? About 4 years ago, I closed a very successful business that I was running because I was exhausted, because it was successful, and yet every other day I would wake up feeling awful. And so I've always done exercise, and I've always done a mixture of things, running, cycling, tennis, and to the point, I got to the point where I shut down the business and I just thought, I used to have to cycle to work. Wherever the office was, I would cycle there purely because I couldn't function in there any other way. I would have to have that 45 minutes of getting myself going in order to be able to face anyone, to be able to face the day. But it is exhausting, as I say. So I closed my business and I just took 2 years off, and I all of these things help, don't get me wrong. I did a lot of meditation, I did a lot of CBT, mindfulness, anything but the drugs, essentially, that I have, they're always there, an updated packet. And it's really, it's just absolutely exhausting. And I've changed my diet, I was vegan for a while, I was vegetarian, I am vegetarian. And really, the thing I've come to realize at 40 is that and it sounds ominous and it sounds sad, but actually it's quite liberating for me, and I don't know if this will help, but it's the truth. I've just accepted that it's not going to go. I mean, maybe if I do take the drugs eventually, maybe it will go, but I don't feel like it's going to go entirely. And I think that the things that I do in my life that help, I just need to be very focused on. So yes, meditation helps, mindfulness helps. This year, I've started taking cycling a lot more seriously, not just cycling to work, but actually making it something I do for those 5 days out of seven. It really helps me. It means I can have a normal day. I described it to someone the other day as, I can get to ambivalent. Ambivalent is my A game. You know, I normally sit below that. But if I do the right things, I can get to ambivalent. I'm cool with that. So sounds quite depressing, but actually talking about it for the first time with people, only really this year, apart from talking therapy that I've done before, started talking, finding myself, because I've taken up cycling more and more, talking to friends on the bike about it. And it's funny, I was saying to someone I'm working with the other day, when I'm on the bike, I feel like I can open up more. And I wonder why that is. Is it because there's endorphins? Is it because, you know, I don't know, because we're friends and we're out and we're not in near where I live, or we're out in the countryside or in the hills? And they said there's actually a study which shows that that men, and this is obvious, when they're side by side, can open up a lot more than when they're looking at each other. And it's something as simple as that, which I've really found has been incredibly helpful. And my friend Jamie's down here, who's part of Black Dog, and we were, the group of us, just talking about this, cyclists, and just, you know, and then suddenly it's that thing where someone talks about it, someone says, actually, me too. And so there's a group of us who I wouldn't, if you had to get asked me to pick people who are depressed, they would be probably the last people. You know, they are all the things that I aspire to be, and yet they suffer from depression and anxiety. So to bring it to Black Dog and what we're trying to do, we are in the process of launching Black Dog Cycle Club. Black Dog being what we, sure, a lot of you know, what Winston Churchill used to call his depression, say it's the Black Dog. And we just want to sort of create an identity where you can have a Black Dog sticker, you can have a Chainstay sticker, whatever. Producing some.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Apparel as well. And you can wear it, you can put a sticker on your bike, and it just means, it's just a signifier to say, if you want to talk, I'm here. You want to do it when we're in the hills and we're side by side and you feel more comfortable because you're a man and you're macho and it's easier that way, then all the better. Equally, you know, anyone who wants to talk, and it's just almost something where we want to say, to your point actually, that it's okay to talk about this. In this day and age, more and more people are coming out and talking about mental health, and it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, or where you're from. If this is something you're going through, you know, I'm in, and I'm willing to talk to you. So, essentially, that's my story. Whether it helps or not, I'm not sure. But Black Dog is coming. So, if it's something that you want to know more about, or you want to get involved in, then please, we'd love to have you. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Now we're going to hand over to cycling presenter, blogger, journalist, author now as well. The book coming very soon. It's Jules John Walker.
Hi, everyone. First off, I want to say that it means a lot to be up here with all of you, and it means a lot that you've all come to listen to this as well. I may end up going off on a tangent, so for that, I apologise profusely. And I'm going to talk about myself. And I'm going to talk about my depression. And I'm going to talk about the fact that I've started to be honest about it, because that's something that I hadn't done for a very long time, especially with my cycling. So I don't know if any of you know me or follow me on social media, but I tweet on Instagram under Lady Bello. And I started to be quite honest on there quite recently about my depression, because it has come back. It never really went away. It's settled, but it's definitely come back with a vengeance quite recently. I was actually diagnosed with depression when I was 29, and that was 2 years into cycling already. So one of those things that was up on the board that was talking about, you know, you can't be unhappy when you're on a bike. Yeah, you're fucking down. I had bad times. I had seriously bad times. And at 29, when I finally got diagnosed, I knew from years before that I was suffering. I knew what the symptoms were because I grew up in a house where depression was definitely a thing. So my mother suffers from depression. She has her up days, she has her really bad days as well. And I grew up around that, so I knew what I was looking at. And I recognised it. And I didn't talk about it because that's not what we did. So there's the stigma that's around depression anyway, that you don't talk about mental health issues. But on top of that, for me, there was also the stigma within Afro-Caribbean communities where you don't talk about things like that as well. So I watched my mum kind of suffer in silence, but take medication for it as well, but we just never talked about it. I'd watch her having breakdowns. I'd see her having panic attacks. There would be times, and I'm really sorry, Mum, if you're watching this on Facebook, but she had it bad. You know, one of my heaviest memories that I had was coming home from school one day and finding her under the dining room table hiding and crying and having to deal with that essentially on my own because my brother and my sister are much older than me and they've left home, and my mum and dad, they kind of had a very rocky relationship. I didn't really have a crutch or anyone that I could lean on in that sense, so I just carried that around. And at 29, when things started to get quite bad for me, the big reveal for me came, and Sarah, you might be able to relate to this, because something that you said in your story of Total Women's Cycling was quite similar to how it happened to me. I was washing up in the kitchen with Ian, my partner, one Sunday evening, and I smashed a glass. And I lost my shit when that happened because I was in such a bad place anyway. The glass smashed, I smashed, and he literally had to scoop me up off of the floor because I was just crying in the kitchen. And I just told him, like, we'd been together for some time at that point, and he knew that I had my down days, but that was when I actually told him. He was the first person I really told that things are shit. I am unhappy, I know what is wrong with me, and something has to be done. And he was the one that talked me into going to the doctor, which I definitely didn't want to do, because I knew I would then have to confront it. I would have to admit that something was wrong. And there was the absolute fear in regards to going on medication as well, because it almost felt like that was a mark of failure if that was going to happen. But then I needed to recognise that I had to have help as well. So went to the doctor, had a slightly uncomfortable conversation with him. My doctor was great, but for me it was uncomfortable because I was confronting what was going on and was put on a course of citalopram. And in amongst all of this, when I started talking to very, very close friends, so this is the most in the sense that we're talking about it now, so congratulations everyone, you know my deepest, darkest secrets. One of the things they were saying to me is, well, you're on your bike. Your bike's going to make you really happy. You know, you'll be able to go out and get the fresh air. You'll enjoy it. The endorphins will be amazing. And all the time, I could think to myself, is putting my ass on a saddle is the last thing that I want to do. There were days where I felt like I couldn't even get myself out of bed. So the idea of actually forcing myself to get on the bike, because that was definitely going to make me happy. It was definitely going to change everything, and everything was going to be sweetness and light again. It wasn't. But I did go through a process of listening to that and that kind of rhetoric that was around it, that sport will make you better, cycling will make you happier. I was seeing it on social media. I was seeing it in other cycling magazines. It had to be true. So I went for it and I did it. And I'll be honest, it didn't help me at all because I wasn't listening to myself and what was actually going to make me happy, what I needed to do. But I still carried on doing it, thinking this is going to make everything better. And on top of that, there was the pressure of actually having to say to people within the cycling community, this isn't actually working for me. This isn't what I need right now. But there's the absolute embarrassment and humiliation of not feeling great about it and being within the industry as well made it difficult to say anything. So we were talking before about social media and some of the messages that are put out there. and cycling publications or what have you that's there, where the pressure feels like it's really hard, and especially when you're sitting there scrolling through Instagram, looking at all of your friends or, you know, close acquaintances having an amazing time out on their bikes or doing laps around Regent's Park or climbing Box Hill. And there's part of me that's just like, you know what, I'd kind of like to be out there with you doing it. I'm not as good as you, so it'll probably be a bad idea if I went out there and did it, and it's not going to make me happy. I will then make you miserable because I will be having a bad time and everyone's going to hate me. That was the kind of irrational thought process that was going through my head. So for me, actually being insular and staying away from people is what I ended up doing too. But the problem again was I'm not talking about it and I'm not seeing other people within cycling talking about it. Maybe they're not comfortable to talk about it. It doesn't feel like it's an environment where it feels like you can have those conversations. Because if you do, you end up looking like a failure or you're doing something wrong or this isn't for you. And that, for me, just seemed to breed this culture of keeping quiet. And I just felt like I couldn't do that anymore. I just started to use my social media to actually be a bit more honest about it. And being here this evening is a huge deal to be able to talk about it and be completely honest too, because again, everything looks and sounds like it's rosy. You know, I've gone into cycling as a full-time thing. So, you know, as you know, I'm doing a book. Hi, Rhianne, and my editor's in the audience. Writing a book, and I'm being painfully honest about the stuff that's happened there too. So, you know, I remember when I first told people that I was going to be writing a book, there was the first thought of, oh, she's doing a book on cycling and style. There's a bit of that in there, but not a hell of a lot. Or she's going to talk about all of the wonderful rides that she's done and all of the things that she's conquered. There's a bit of that in there too, but I'm talking about the mental side of it that I conquered as well and what I needed, because I think it's so desperately needed to have those conversations and to be honest about it instead of painting everything to be rosy. So, you know, for me, last year, one of the things that knocked me back quite badly was having a mini stroke. And that changed a lot for me. That slowed me down in every way possible. And I needed to stop and I needed to recognize that something was wrong. And the reason for that stroke was stress. There was a history of stroke in the family. But this is people that were in like their 70s and their 80s in my family that are having a stroke. So at 33 years old, that was insane that that happened. And I knew I was putting myself under immense pressure at work, because at that point I was working in the cycling industry. Immense pressure to have this persona that I wanted to present to people, that everything was wonderful. That wasn't doing me any favours. I was just chipping away at myself slowly and yet just slapping a mask on and just pretending that everything was okay. And eventually that did lead to a burnout. And, you know, I always said to myself, there is every single chance that I may end up back on my medication again. I still have a prescription for it. I held on to my last box of Citalopram as well as just a reminder, which sounds a bit morbid, but I keep it in my vanity case, and every now and then I do have a look at it and remember that I was at that point. And there is absolutely no shame if I end up at that point all over again, because I know they helped me. Talking to people helped me as well. People being aware that that was going on with me was essential as well, and not to have the stigma or the embarrassment or the shame of talking about it, and not being ashamed of the fact that there are some days where if I don't want to go out on my bike, if I don't want to be riding with friends, if I don't even want to be riding with Ian, that's okay. That's absolutely fine. I'm not a badass. I've never said that I was ever a badass, but there was just this feeling that that's how you're supposed to portray yourself, and I'm tired of doing that. It was exhausting, and I learned the hard way last year when I ended up in hospital with that stroke. Don't lie to yourself, don't burn yourself out. You know, even just checking in on people, as we were saying before, just to check in on your friends, make sure they're okay. If they've disappeared off the radar for a while, perhaps they have wanted to do that. Pick up a phone, send a text message. Talk. So all you need to do is talk, because it makes such a huge difference. And being up here and talking to you is making a massive difference to me right now. She says, pulling her eyes out. But it means a lot. It does absolutely mean a lot. And one of the things, and I don't know if I'm going to run, but I'm going to talk about it, is how secretive I have been certain things with my cycling as well. So I've been blogging for 7 years. I've been riding bikes for 7 years. I started off on the Pashley, ended up riding a bit of track, some fixed gear. I haven't done mountain biking yet. Adele, we're going to have to do that at some stage. Thanks. But the one thing that happened a few weeks ago on my way to a big ride was I had my first ever puncture. Now, I've been riding for 7 whole years.
Wow.
I don't know, babes. I don't know. It just hasn't happened. I look after my bikes to a degree. So I'm precious with my bikes, but not precious enough that I actually know how to maintain them properly. So the puncture happened. It was me and Ian, as always, riding along together. We were on our way to go and do the Stroke Association ride. We were basically riding to go to Waterloo to get the train. CS3, fine. Get across the A100, fine. Great Tower Street, where the walkie-talkie is, on the bike. All of a sudden, I just feel like I'm going like this as I'm riding. And I'm like, oh, this is different. Not felt that before. And I kind of shouted to Ian, because he's ahead of me, Ian, something feels a bit weird with my bike, and I don't know what it is. Going along, he looked back, and he just kind of signals to me, like, pull over. So we do. And he's like, oh, congratulations, you've got your first ever puncture. And I was like, oh, it's the fact that I didn't even recognise that's what had happened. It just, the bike felt weird. That's all I knew. And immediately, it's like, you know, we had the inner tubes, we had the tyre levers, had the multi-tool. Did I know what to do with it? No. Immediately, I did not know what to do. And I cycle-shamed myself with this as well, because when it happened, Ian, the gentleman that he is, stepped in and did it. Because I didn't have a clue what I was supposed to do. I literally did have all the gear and no idea what to do with it. And that's not a lie. It was just, let him do it. Took a picture of him doing it, put it on social media and just said, first ever puncture, boyfriend is changing it for me because I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And that was the kick that I needed, actually having a puncture. And instead of just riding on sheer luck to do something about it. So I'm now doing a course with London Bike Kitchen on basic introduction to maintenance, and there's that whole thing of, shit girl, you've been cycling for 7 years and you're now doing a basic course. Yes, I am, because I would admit I didn't want anyone to know that I wasn't skilled on that at all. I was constantly surrounded by people that were helping me do that. I had my partner that would step in. That was amazing. I worked in the industry, so even when we were flying off and going and doing photo shoots and that, my bike was being broken down for me by the guys in the office, built when we got to the other end to do the shoot as well. And all I wanted to do was dive in and go for it, and I couldn't. And it was the embarrassment that it had rolled on for so long that I couldn't say anything about it. So I just let that slide. And now I'm at the point where I am a grown-up. I probably should have known to have done this a long time ago, and I'm holding my hand up now. And even being able to say that out loud feels really good that I'm doing a maintenance course. But again, it's just that whole thing of being honest with yourself, talking to each other as well and listening, and maybe not letting the pressure that can be around in cycling crush you. So I'm going to keep on talking. I'm going to keep on being honest. I'm going to keep on learning. And I'm always going to remember that I do suffer from depression. It doesn't define me, but I accept that it's part of who I am. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Could you just hand the microphone back to Sarah for a minute? Because we've obviously heard so many points, that something that I've picked up on that everybody's touched upon this evening already is that fear of failure in cycling. You have this upwards drive, you perhaps, as you did, Sarah, you start racing, and there's so much positivity that comes from that. But I think we've all had it, I've certainly had it, where you start to build up this fear of going out, maybe with the club run or the race that you plan to go to, because you see, especially on social media, everybody else saying, oh, you know, I've barely trained, and then they turn up and they smash it, and you're that person that's suddenly on the back foot. How do you deal with that pressure? What would be your advice?
I'd probably go and train on my own. I've been doing that quite a lot recently, partly because my job is sort of fairly intense, and I don't think I sort of flagged this up earlier, but in the last 4 years that I've been working in mental health, coordinating a social support project for people who've been through psychological therapy services with the NHS, and actually, I think at the moment, I've sort of manoeuvred myself out of those sort of situations where I'm feeling awkward about being off the mat. We've talked about the kind of issues when you can't perform in the way that you might have done in the past and how difficult that is, whether that's kind of injury, whether it's mental health related, and being able to kind of face that long kind of slog maybe to get back to where you were. And I think that it comes up again and again about perhaps being honest with yourself and just being able to be aware and to recognise what's going on. But also, I mean, it's a bit of a buzzword in mental health at the moment, but being able to practice a bit of self-compassion, because it's so easy to slip into that guilt in yourself, to use those obligation statements of, oh, I should be doing this, I ought to be better, and to allow yourself a bit of space to step back and go, okay, well, it's like this today, it's not going to be like it for the foreseeable future, and be able to kind of be a bit more sort of present. But I think it's sometimes it's of just perhaps going off and finding your own space within cycling, or even something that I've experienced in the last few years. I mean, I was doing racing for a bit, but when I first started racing, the people who were sort of turning up the first races, we were all pretty much on an even keel. We were perhaps good club riders. Might have done a few sporties and suddenly gone, okay, we're going to give this racing arc a go. Now if you turn up to race, there's a chance of people who have trained right through the winter, they probably have a coach, in my case, they're probably half my own age. And it's a question of readjusting your boundaries, because you can't always say, well, I can expect to best the field in a new 1, 2, 3, 4 race if they are putting more hours in, because my life has changed, it's sort of different. I think it's a real sort of, it can be a real wake up, and it's very tough to sort of come to terms with that a lot of the time, and it's very easy to kind of slide into that sort of, why aren't I good enough? Why aren't I performing? Why can't I hang on to the back of the field? But it's realizing that a lot of people are doing sort of similar things and probably kind of going through similar thought patterns to you as well. But they're probably all kind of doing the secret training, or not. But I think, you know, take joy from other elements of it, whether it's the social side of cycling, or whether it's investigating a maintenance class, maybe coming at it from a slightly different angle. You know, for a lot of people it's difficult through the winter, because it takes much more energy to get out the front door and get out on the bike. I tend to rely on turbo classes during the winter. They kind of save my sanity when the night goes, because you can get kind of quality hour of training, rather than thinking, oh, well, I want to go out for kind of 2-3 hours on the bike at the weekend, something like that. So it's just sort of finding what's out there and kind of tailoring it to, I guess. But also giving yourself a bit of space to be self-compassionate when, you know, you might be feeling particularly sort of drained, you might be particularly tired, you might even be at that point where someone asks you, do you want a tea or a coffee? And you're like, I can't make a decision because my brain, my cognitive dysfunction is that I can't actually make any sort of decisions myself at the moment. And to put aside that and give yourself a bit of time and, yeah, be kind to yourself.
And I think, again, so many of us here will have had that moment in whatever cycling scenario where you think you're the only one suffering, right? And you just kind of get to that point where you say, do you know what, I'm cracking, guys, this pace is too hard, I'm struggling, I'm suffering. How many people turn around and go, oh, I'm so glad you said that. I really, really want to ease off the pace, but no one wants to be the first to say it. And I'd like everyone to kind of expand with their advice here. Do you often find, as Jules was saying earlier, by talking about it, Adele, actually a lot of people say, me too, I'm struggling.
I really do, yes, but someone's got to say it first. I think one great piece of advice, what I find works for me is who I write with is really important. So there are, when I first started, there weren't that many women who rode, so you'd often end up, we'd often go out and ride with men. They would be more experienced, fitter, stronger. So largely you wouldn't see what they were doing because they disappeared. So you would sort of struggle around on your own. Started to ride with women, and that's great. But the thing I think which is most important when you're riding with women or men is that you ride with people who are kind of in a similar ballpark of experience to you. So because I think you find that if you see someone who's really good doing a technical descent, for instance, you can really admire what they're doing, but you can't imagine how you will ever do the same thing. If you see someone who you ride with and you think you're kind of similar level doing it, then that gives you the confidence to have a go. I ride sometimes with a women's group locally who are called the Surrey Hills Mountain Bike Chicks. They got together because Hope, who makes mountain bike components, have got an initiative where they're organising women's rides around the country. They did one in my local area, and the women that turned up, I think 50 women turned up to do it, which is a lot for mountain biking. And we all decided that we would kind of keep in touch on Facebook, and it's now become quite an established group. And there's a whole variety of abilities within that group. But when we get together, it's a really supportive ride because the women who are exceptionally good are kind of willing to show everybody what to do rather than show off. And it's a very supportive group because you get all sorts of levels within that group. So I think it's really important that you ride with the right people. And now, I suppose the great thing about it, now there are more people riding, it's easier to find those groups.
We've been talking for a while, so at this point I'm going to say, has anyone got any questions? I'm sure there's lots to come this evening. Who wants to ask first? And if not, do we have any coming in on social media?
I'm also somebody who has been prescribed medication that I don't take and keep off for reasons that I've got, which is my own. I thought I was the only weirdo doing it. So kind of reassuring to hear I'm not. But I'm just wondering why don't we and what's the tea? Presumably it would help a lot of us to take it. And so why aren't we?
So I have a wife who is not anti-medication, but she'll question a lot what medication the benefits are, and I'm kind of probably from a culture growing up where if you prescribe medication, it's probably for a good reason. So you know the doctor's much cleverer than I am, so I'm going to take it. I think it got to a point for me where I decided to take my medication where I'm kind of done everything else. I've tried every avenue. I've tried talking therapy. I've tried other things, and I was just at a point where it was what next, and so I started taking the medication, and for me I think a lot of nervousness is in it. I won't lie to you, and the side effects were grim, and there was times where I thought maybe I should stop, but you kind of when you start to see the way that you feel afterwards for me. It was such a flip side in who I was. It wasn't that it suddenly created a new Bruce. It's that it helped me to work through mentally. I think that a little bit of mental stability to start to make decisions, I was able to kind of be calm enough to see through the cloud, as it were, and make decisions about what shirt I was going to wear in the morning, or you know, would I watch TV or would I type on my laptop. It was just basic decisions that the medication helped me work through. And one of the side effects from being ill for me was that I wasn't sleeping, and so I was taking sleeping tablets as well. The doctor suggested that I take those because I wasn't getting any sleep, and that doesn't have any good impact on your mental health either. And so I'd been taking those for a while, on and off, trying to get a sleep pattern going. And she said, well, actually, there's another antidepressant you can take, which actually, if you take it at night, it would help you. And I did a bit of research on that one, and the side effects and things from that I didn't really agree with. And so I put that one in the drawer and decided that I was going to try and work through the sleep issues myself. But the positives of actually being able to wake up in the morning that the other drug was giving me kind of surpassed the thought process of should I shelve that one or not. So I think I'm on two camps, as it were, for that. But I can definitely say I don't think it's right or wrong. But I think for me, the benefits of having tried everything and getting to that point, and actually, it wasn't just the drugs that I think was the benefit. I think it was the person that issued me the drugs. I think the doctor talked through everything with me and my wife. She explained what it was, what do we do, what the side effects were, the positives, the negatives, how long, how much, did I think I could take less, did I think I could take more. And when we left the surgery, I felt more informed than any Google or any book could have told me. She talked it through, and it was like she said, it happened like. And I think that, for me, was comforting, in that we're working together with a practitioner who actually knew, I felt they knew what they were talking about. Again, that's my personal experience, but...
Can I ask you a question, actually? Because I've never met anyone else who's done this. What have you done to not take them?
I've done a variety of things, and actually one of the things as well was I find, to your point actually, I found things quite an interesting analogy, because I feel like if you suffer with anything like this, your mind feels, I should say, feels like it's ups and downs, it's like you're up and downhill, so sometimes you're absolutely fine, you're freewheeling and you're like, I don't even remember what it was like going up that hill, and then you hit the next hill and you're like, oh right, oh I'll get another hill, right, let's see, and then you get another down, and then you get another hill, and I think for me, I just had to realise, a bit like you, I think, that like there's just always going to be another hill, and then there's going to be another down. So I do a variety of probably similar to you, I think, for me now, I feel like I've spotted coming a lot better, so I'm able to defend it off to ahead of it really getting bad, and that seems to work for me. But for some bizarre reason,
yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, yeah, so when I was young, when I was at university and I was prescribed them, it makes no sense, because it's not even that I thought, oh, if I take these, I'm going to become a zombie, or it's bad for my health, because I would just do every other drug going under the sun, or alcohol, or what have you. So it wasn't even, I don't know, it's almost like it's symbolic, like you're giving up. It's really interesting to hear what you say, because I've never had the other side. So really interesting, an odd thing happened. The last time I was prescribed antidepressants, because it got bad, and it's almost like that is part of my recovery. That I go to the doctor, I say I can't take this anymore, I'm doing lots of exercise, I've got a great diet, blah blah blah, what else, and he says, well, you need to go on antidepressants. The last time that happened was in January, and I took the prescription to the chemist, and I bought the antidepressants, and I was just paying for them, and I paid, and I was just getting ready to go. One of the other chemists, who wasn't serving me, but just, I don't know, I've been talking, whatever, he came in and he said, are you sure you want those? And I thought, this is an intervention. What's going on here? This is really, what's going to happen now? And it's a bit like Highway to Heaven or something. I've got a proper intervention. And so he said, this is my pharmacy, and I've seen so many people, including doctors, come in with the dosage that you're getting to kick them off. 5 years later, they're on way higher dosage and they're no better, and they're just dependent on those. Have you thought about other ways? And I said, well, funny you should say that. 20 years of other ways to deal with it. And he said, you know what you should do? You should I'll refund you those. Just take these instead. And he gave me a load of supplements. So just vitamin supplements, ones you take at night, magnesium that you take before you go to bed, vitamin D replacement, because obviously we suffer with short days and during the winter and lack of light. And that's a big issue for me. That's something I didn't talk about earlier, but the lack of daylight, the lack of sunshine, it gets a lot worse during the winter. And I try. So I said, great. So I took them away. And it's a little bit like, and I don't know how this works with you, but it's a little bit like the yoga, the meditation, the mindfulness. I do it really religiously for about a month, and then I forget. And then it kicks the cycle off again. And so that may well be a solution to do it that way, but I just never have the resilience or the... I never stick with it long enough, I don't think. The only thing, and this is very pertinent to why we're all here, but the only thing that works that I do religiously is cycling, because it's such an immediate impact for me. Literally half an hour in and the black dog's lifted, or to a degree, which gets better and better. So, yeah.
Sarah, do you want to expand on that topic?
Just to sort of go back about the possible sort of issue about why you don't take them. I mean, certainly that when I started taking them, that it was a bit of a revelation. I was one of those people who took antidepressants, someone that I'd never considered that I was before. And so it was a bit of a... I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have a really good GP at the time. And a lot of it does depend on having a very good... doctor that you can discuss them through thoroughly, and we sort of discussed the possibility of going on antidepressants. But I think at the time, for me, that was something that I needed to get myself out of the pit, because I couldn't start my recovery proper until I could function at a sort of fairly basic level, and the antidepressants allowed me to do that. So, and I was been on and off fluoxetine for about 13, 14 years, I suppose. The last 6 months I've actually phased off them, and it's been the first time I've been off them for a while for some years. And yes, there are the last few boxes that I'm sort of keeping hold of. If anyone needs any, drop me a line. But yeah, I can't kind of throw them away. So I think it's kind of like a safety net, just in case things get so bad that maybe, just maybe. But having gone on and off them intermittently for a few years, I kind of I do know the pattern of when it gets bad, and even in terms of the side effects, that what I can expect and how long it's going to kick in, and also about phasing off them. And even though I might need them for kind of several years at a go, or have done in the past, that there's always that aim towards, okay, when I'm feeling kind of on top of things again, I can start sort of dropping the dose down. To the point where it's not really, they're not being that effective. I mean, certainly I find that in that immediate sort of pit where the depression is at worst, they're really effective. But then once you started to recover, it's as well, I'm getting up and down, ups and downs anyway. And like you said, it's kind of trying to learn to kind of go with those, and knowing that recovery is not a lovely kind of upward curve where you just get gradually better and better. There's lots of lumps and bumps along the way, and it's kind of learning how to ride those as you go on.
Thank you again, Sarah. Yes, we've got a question at the front.
I'd like to talk again about what you've actually talking about. I was prescribed as a coach, and I found that they made me feel not very good. I mean, it was like stabilized at a very low level. And on the second or third week, I had a box with a brand name on, and side effect. Really cycling, I imagine that I now sleep most nights, and I feel a good night's sleep is the best remedy for minimal illness and time. Because you sleep, and you wake up,
thank you so much. Does anyone want to expand on that at all? Just looking down the line here.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's brilliant that you're able to have that. And I know, you know, when I was talking about how cycling and depression and it works together for me, I do have my moments where getting out on the bike is one of the best things that I can do, and it does help me. But I know when it came to me confronting it and realizing all those years ago when I finally got diagnosed, I know I was running away from it. That's what I was doing. I was completely running away from it. I didn't want to confront it. And just like you were saying, Sarah, it's realizing you're one of those people that's going to be taking medication. And I know when I started my escitalopram, the side effects, because it took about, 4 to 6 weeks or so for it to actually kick into the system, was horrible. I was feeling sick. I was tired, which was slightly refreshing because I wasn't sleeping that well, which sounds weird, but it was the absolute knackeredness that came with it. And all I wanted to do was sleep when I was taking them, and just the grogginess that came with it. But they did start to make me feel better. They didn't cure what was going on with me, but I know that that was a step that I needed to take. I was on them. So I was on them for some time, and then I knew I made the decision when I was at a certain level that felt comfortable for me, I wanted to come off of them. So my dosage was lowered, and gradually I was weaned off of them, and I did hang on to the box. I can't take them because they expired in 2015, so I'm still hanging on to them because it's just a reminder. But I know, and I'm lucky, that I do also have the option as well of getting on the bike, going, getting the fresh air, if it's not a stressful situation, because sometimes cycling in London is the last thing that I want to be doing if I'm feeling stressed out. But I can get on the bike at my own pace. But I also know that I have the option of not getting on the bike if that doesn't work for me as well. So again, for me, it's just recognizing pressure, not applying pressure to myself, and also because of what I've been through with my depression, being able to recognize the signs and the symptoms when something is coming on, which is what's going on with me at the moment. But I recognized that something was up, and I just started talking about it again. So it's just doing what is right for you. If getting on the bike makes you happy, if it's gonna raise your endorphins, if you're in a position where you don't have to go on medication or have to rely on that, then that's amazing. And that's brilliant that you're able to do that. But there's also no shame or no stigma if you have to go down the other route as well. But it's basically finding the level ground for yourself that works for you.
Thank you, Jules. Oh, yeah, one question over here.
I actually set up bikes, offering bikes for our service users, with health and vocational support, and also a lot of accredited practitioners. But what I actually wanted to share with people is that something that may help in terms of medication. My mother was lifelong bipolar, and in and out of psychiatric care, 5 sessions right there, and she passed in care. And after her second breakdown, when I was 16, I'm now in my 50s, 40 years ago, there wasn't the internet. And I went to go see, actually, my school, my chemistry teacher, to find out how come this little pill that my mum took determined which mum I got on any given day. And my chemistry teacher's help with my geography and geology, I found out what was in this medication was lithium. And what I learned at that time, not many people are aware of even now in NHS or GPs, the highest concentrations of lithium anywhere in the world are in South America. In fact, Bolivia holds 70% of the world's deposits. The lowest instances of mental ill health anywhere in the world are in South America. And where lithium is found, its core trace element is water. And what I learned on the journey through mental health over 40 odd years is that, for the most part, people who are taking medications are not drinking sufficient quantities of water. They may have juices, fizzy drinks, alcohol that doesn't interfere with the medication, milk, or whatever, juices, but usually not enough water. There's a need to have more of it because we need to distill water down to oil residue. We know the bottles you've all got up there. You know, we know the other things that are in there, but what's also in there is that and cyclists need to rehydrate. So there have been studies that have been done on this, and I would just say just sharing freely, just try and drink a little bit more water. I'm not saying it's a cure-all, but I know where my mum was concerned, and I know I've been in cycling for the last 6 years. It helps.
Thank you. Very much appreciated. And I was going to say, I'm going to leave the questions there because I know a few people have got to nip off and ride home shortly. But everyone here will... Oh, sorry,
is there anything else you
need? Wrong time, sorry. but yes, I was going to say, tonight's panellists will be sticking around because I know there might be some questions that people don't want to add to the whole floor. So please, please do ask away. And we stick around for the next half an hour to an hour afterwards, please do join us for a drink. There are some leaflets of useful links, information, and we've got some more pamphlets and information which we hope everyone finds helpful just down there by the door. But yes, everyone will be sticking around, so do ask away, but please join me and once again saying...
I just say one last thing.
Of course.
Movember here is representing Movember. They're doing amazing work with mental health. I don't know if you've seen their viral that they've done with cycling and mental health, but it's brilliant. So if you want to check that out, please do it. And it's obviously November, so support any Mobro or Mo Sister that you can. That's all I wanted to say.
Anyone else? Any last final words from anyone? Okay, cool. Thank you so much, and please put your hands together finally. For all tonight's panelists, Rowan, Ruth, Jules, Adele, and Sarah. And thanks to everyone for being part tonight.
Once again, big thank you to Sarah for this. If you like what we do, please like, rate, and subscribe. We're on iTunes, we're on SoundCloud, and you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at WheelsuckersPod. If there's someone you know who might find this useful to listen to, please share it with them. If you have some comments, advice, other links, get in touch. You know what to do. Goodbye, friends!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.